Hello, and welcome to 2010 Healthcare Reconciliation Bill, application of 3.8% surtax to trusts and estates. This is Bob Keebler, and joining me today is Carol Quintel from Texas, and many will recognize Carol as a true expert in the world of trusts, having been heavily involved in litigating the Knight case, and more importantly, she's testified before the U.S. Congress on trust and estate issues. Carol, good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
Carol, I thought what we'd do today is I would give a little overview of the 3.8% surtax, and then I want to focus in on your expertise on how all this will apply to trusts and talk about the planning we're seeing and the planning we're not seeing, and basically just how onerous this is going to be in the world of trusts. So by now, many of you know that there's a new 3.8% Medicare tax that's going to be imposed on the lesser of net investment income or the excess of modified adjusted gross income over the threshold amount. So net investment income would be things like interest, dividends, capital gains, annuities, rents, royalties, passive activity income. So net investment income doesn't include wages or active trader business income, but you can see, or IRA income. But in the world of trust, most of what we deal with in the world of trust will probably be subject to the investment income rule in the 3.8%. Now, there's a lot of things that go on here, and in particular why we wanted Carol's help today was to discuss the application of Section 67 when we try to apply general trust tax law to the special surtax. Now, the interesting thing is for these rules, the threshold amount for a married couple is $250,000. So a married couple could earn $249,000 in investment income, and if that was all their income, they wouldn't pay a penny of tax. But the threshold for trusts is going to start right at about $11,000. So, Carol, let's talk about that for a moment. So how did Congress come up with the $11,000, and why is it somewhat discriminatory against trusts, and how do we work around this?
Well, somewhat is an interesting word of the day here, but it is extremely discriminatory. But that's nothing unusual. Trusts have generally drawn the short stick, whether it's rate bracket compression or unindexed AMT exemptions, but they determine the threshold by the dollar amount at which the highest tax bracket begins in Section 1E, which is $11,200 in 2010. Probably will go up a little bit from there by the time the surtax comes in play, but not much, which means just about everything that the trust earns may be subject to the surtax.
So are you saying that if a trust earns, say, $61,500, that the trust would pay the surtax on $50,000?
Well, of course, they've got the same comparison. You've got the adjusted gross income on one hand. It's the lesser of adjusted gross income under Section 67E or the net investment income, both of which are reduced by distributions to beneficiaries. And then the AGI if that is the lesser of, it is AGI minus the $11,200. So it really depends, and it's critical for a trust or an estate to determine which is less adjusted gross income or net investment income. And that will definitely vary from trust to trust. I think with an individual, you don't have that sort of anomaly going on. With an individual, I think your net investment income is pretty much always going to be less than adjusted gross income, because the individual has many other sources of income. They've got wages, generally. They've got IRA distributions and a lot of other types of expenses that would increase the AGI and make that higher. With an estate or trust, it just varies.
So this is, let me just ask a couple, give you a couple examples and see if we understand this correctly. I represent an estate. The estate has $100,000 worth of income, and it makes no distributions whatsoever, but it pays deductible estate administration expenses to the lawyers and CPAs of $25,000. So we have $100,000 of investment income, and we pay $25,000 to the lawyers and the CPAs to administer the estate. What would the surtax be imposed on, $100,000 or $75,000?
Well, that raises a very good question. We have to ask ourselves, are these expenses, these $25,000 of expenses, the type that are deducted above the line or below the line? Typically, legal accounting professional fees have been deducted above the line. That's the way the 1041 form is drafted, has been for years. But I think since the Knight case, there's some question about what types of expenses, even things we've taken for granted, like professional fees, are really deducted above the line. But let's, for example, say that it is above the line. It's an above-the-line deduction. So your AGI is $100,000 minus $25,000 or $75,000 minus the threshold of $11,200. So you have about a $64,000 or so AGI, and our net investment income is now $75,000. So the lesser of those two is the AGI because we were able to deduct those expenses. So it's 3.8% of the $64,000.
Okay, now I understand. Let me give you, let's say we had the same case, but the legal and accounting expenses were deducted on the federal estate tax return, so they can't be deducted on the trust, but the trustee pays everything out to the beneficiaries. So would there be a surtax yet at the trust level, or can the trust take a D&I deduction for the surtax purposes?
The taxes on the undistributed AGI and net investment income, AGI is by definition undistributed, but if the trustee distributes everything, there is no surtax, and that's one of the planning opportunities is to distribute all of the D&I, and hopefully if you do that, the beneficiary will not be subject to the surtax because they have a much higher threshold that they can stay under before they meet that $250,000 or $125,000. So I would say distribute and distribute and distribute, all other things being equal.
Right. Now, let me ask you a question, which is going to take a little bit of thought. But let's say that we have a client that dies on January 2nd, 2012, the year before the surtax comes into play. So we have a choice of either going with a calendar year, which would end 12/31/12, or we could go with like a fiscal year that ended 11/30/12. Am I right that if we go with a fiscal year, there might be a tactical advantage in that the surtax would actually could be pushed out another 11 months? Can you help us with those rules, Carol?
The surtax applies for an estate or trust or anyone for that matter, for tax years beginning after 12/31/2012, which means anybody who, essentially for an estate, and that's what you're talking about, anyone who dies in 2013 or afterward is subject to the surtax. So if you died before 1/1/2013, you definitely can select a fiscal year end and defer out that estate, that surtax. For example, in your case where you have a date of death January 2nd, 2012, that fiscal year starts January 3rd, 2012, which is before 12/31/2012. So if you select a November 30, 2012 year end, you do not have the surtax applying there.
For the first year. But then in the second year, my second year would start 12/1/12.
Right. So and you have 2 years of deferral, in a sense.
I would, in essence, have 2 years of deferral. That's what I was trying to get at and trying to think through. So that's going to be a powerful thing that we have to look at. Now, with that also, we were talking about an estate, per se. But if I make the election to consolidate my trust, my administrative trust, and my estate, I could also get the same treatment for the first year or two of my administrative trust. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that may be one good reason to make a Section 645 election, which is what you're talking about. If you have a living trust, you can elect to treat it as an estate, and that would buy it the opportunity to select this fiscal year. Dynamite planning opportunity and another reason to make that election. Where that list is growing now. I think it's that's a good point, Bob.
Now, let's switch to an ongoing trust, just plain vanilla ongoing trust. Lots of taxable income, very conservatively invested. Assuming the document would allow for this type of flexibility, am I right that municipal bonds are not going to be considered when you compute your investment income?
That's correct, because investment income is only items of gross income, and gross income excludes tax-exempt income.
So with the rate going from a trust on investment income, today the rate on a trust would be 35% if I was trapping my income. And tomorrow, in 2011, it goes to 39.6%. But then, you know, when we wake up in 2013, the rate on investment income, if you're trapping in a trust, will go, I guess, to 43.4%. Does that sound correct?
You're adding the 39.6
plus the 3.8. And
yeah.
I guess the bigger picture point is we could look at moving portfolios more into munis.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
I guess in some circumstances, if the document allows it, you could use life insurance as a tax shelter. And thirdly, in some circumstances, I think we can use annuities in trusts that are just for individuals. So there may be opportunities here that we'll have to explore in the months to come. Now,
very definitely.
I'm going to throw a difficult question at you, very unfair considering how new this law is. But, you know, many of our listeners represent people with real estate. And walk me through the difference between active real estate and passive. So let's say the trustee manages a building, and no doubt, I mean, the trustee, the building is 100% owned by the trust. The trustee is very active in the management of the business. It's the decedent's son. He's there every day doing
right.
the things you would do to run a building. If that's active, would the surtax apply?
Unfortunately, yes. And the reason is that any passive activity, and let me just hang on that for just a second. A rental income is per se passive under Code Section 469 because the thought is, I don't care how active you get, it's still passive. It does not take a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to collect a rent check. And so even if you're active under the passive loss rules, it doesn't get you out of the surtax for 3.8% because you're still a passive real estate investor. Whether you're an active passive investor, and I know that's terribly confusing, but if it's passive, it is, I mean, if it's rental, it's passive and it's subject to the surtax. You know, but the nice thing about real estate is you do get your depreciation deductions against the income. You just simply can't take the loss.
So let's say I'm a trustee and my document is very flexible and I'm evaluating the purchase of a 15-year lease from a very strong corporation or putting my money in corporate bonds. On the corporate bond side, my rate would be 43.4%. On the real estate side, the rate's the same, but I'm depreciating that building, and that's going to give me some tax shelter. Is that a good way to evaluate that, as long as you're within your fiduciary responsibilities?
Yes, I think so, definitely, and especially if you're producing income. I mean, that's a really nice place to be when you've got real estate, because so many times it's the opposite. You've got deductions in excess of income. And I would think you could even almost net out your, if you had multiple rent properties and some were producing income and some were producing losses, you could almost match up your passive gains and losses and, you know, shelter some of that income with passive losses.
So if I had a building that generated with no debt and fully depreciated that generated $100 worth of income, and another building that generated a $90 loss, you're saying in all likelihood I can net those and my surtax would be imposed on $10.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Good. Well, that's the understanding we need to have. Now, Carol, let's venture out into the world of charitable remainder trusts. Talk about for a moment, if you would, from a planning perspective, how a charitable remainder trust could be used to smooth out income from an individual's perspective, and then talk about, secondly, and maybe more importantly for this call, whether a charitable remainder trust could ever be subject to the 3.8% surtax.
Okay, one at a time. The smoothing out issue, of course, that applies even without the surtax, and that's the reason a large part of the reason people may want to do a charitable remainder trust is because you can sell a property that's highly appreciated, and the charitable remainder trust does not pay an income tax on that gain. The annuity that comes out to the grantor is only taxed as it is received, kind of like an installment sale. So that could definitely smooth out the amount of income subject to the surtax for an individual. That could be a very good thing because their threshold is so high. You know, it's not, I don't know that I've ever seen a trust being a beneficiary of a charitable remainder trust. That's kind of an unusual combination there. But for an individual, definitely, the charitable remainder trust helps the individual avoid the surtax, or at least put it off as maybe permanently avoid it if you smooth it out so that it's below the threshold every year. The charitable remainder trust would be subject to the surtax under the new code section 1411 because the only type of charitable trust completely excluded from the application of that surtax is one where all of the unexpired interests are devoted to charity. And of course, with a charitable lead or remainder trust, there is a non-charitable beneficiary in there somewhere. So, but that being said, it has no teeth because if there's no taxable income, no gross income being generated by the trust, the 3.8% surtax is applied to zero. And so I wouldn't worry too much about that surtax in the case of your charitable remainder trust. But I think they remain a good planning tool for individuals.
Now, even more complex is the charitable lead trust. And for everybody, just to refresh your mind, the charitable lead trust, charity gets the income up front, and then the remainder goes to typically family members. So, Carol, interestingly enough, there's a specific part of the statute that makes it clear to the reader that a charitable lead trust is potentially going to be subject to the surtax. But how would that work?
Well, the trust would have gross income equal to, presumably, capital gains, interest, and dividends. It would receive a charitable contribution deduction for the annuity or the amount dedicated to the charity. Whatever is left is taxed to the trust. And so in that case, you would potentially have a surtax because you would have taxable income in your trust. There'd be no reason for it to be exempt. All of its income is net investment income, and so it goes into the same comparison of AGI, which is the lesser of AGI over the threshold, or net investment income. So, and, you know, the fact that a charitable lead trust is helping us pay for health care is kind of an unusual concept, but that's what our Congress has done.
And that's a great observation. So let me put some math to this. If I had a $100,000 worth of income in a charitable lead trust, and I paid $100,000 out to charity, it matched up perfectly, am I correct that there would be no surtax?
That's correct, because you'd have no undistributed net investment income or AGI.
Right.
Your base is zero.
So that would be if that was all from, let's say, Treasury bonds. Now, if that $100,000 was the income, but my charitable deduction was only $80,000, I would have $20,000 potentially subject to the surtax, except I get to reduce that by my threshold amount. Is that the right way to look at that?
Yes.
So, okay.
That's right.
That's very interesting. So for some charitable trusts, the timing of income may become very important. For example, you might carefully select the timing of when your bonds pay interest in a way that you pick up additional deferral or in a way that you bring the interest into the proper year. So there's going to be a lot of planning that goes on, especially with big charitable lead trusts. Am I right?
That's true. In my own practice, I have very few charitable lead trusts. I have quite a number of charitable remainder trusts, but for some reason the lead trust is sort of a rare bird.
So can you sum up, just give me some big picture thoughts on what an accountant or a lawyer advising a trust, and granted we have, you know, almost 2 years to get up to speed on this, but
right. What
should we be thinking about in the short run, or, you know, in the next 12 months? How do we get our clients ready for this?
That's a very good question, and I think there are two real words or pieces of advice that I could give on that. Number one is that Section 67E that defines which deductions are deductible above the line from adjusted gross income. That's going to be critical. Heretofore, people haven't worried so much about whether investment advisory fees are subject to the 2% floor on miscellaneous itemized deductions, because it's only 2% of gross income, and a lot of people, I mean, for some trusts, that's just peanuts. It's not worth worrying about. But when it comes to the surtax, it makes a huge difference whether your deductions are deductible above the line or not, because if your adjusted gross income is higher than your net investment income, but it's only higher because you haven't taken deductions against it, you might be able to pull that adjusted gross income down by documenting that those expenses are the type that are not commonly incurred by individuals according to the Knight case, and therefore they're deductible from adjusted gross income. You could pull your adjusted gross income down to the lesser of the two, and in that case you've saved 3.8% of those expenses. So it's all boiling down to documentation, and people may not have cared much before whether it was subject to the 2% floor or not, but now that it impacts the surtax, I think people are going to start analyzing their investment expenses, their administrative expenses, and taking more of them from AGI than before. So that's one piece of advice, is just document, document, document. And the second piece is look at your investments. Look at investing in family partnerships, because there are lots of opportunities where you have a flow-through entity that generates capital gains, because capital gains typically can't be distributed if they're generated by the trust, but if they're coming from a flow-through entity, they are included in D&I and can be passed out, again, lowering adjusted gross income and net investment income. Look at municipal bonds. Look at maybe making your trust or estate the beneficiary of an IRA, because that is an exempt item from the net investment income. Passive income generators, passive losses, we've discussed those already. There are just a host of investment opportunities that need to be explored. So those are my two pieces of advice, is look at your documentation on your Section 67E administrative costs, and look at your investment portfolio, because the Uniform Prudent Investor Act gives you pretty much carte blanche to balance risk and reward and get out there and do something besides just stick with the tried and true conservative legal list of investments.
Well, Carol, I want to thank you for joining me today. This is a wonderful call, and I can see just from what I've learned this morning is that you are going to be very busy for the next few years trying to help people with these issues. So, again, thank you so much, and we look forward to having you back on a future call.
Oh, you're absolutely welcome, Bob. I'm hoping to be back again, too.